thought I'd begin this afternoon just with a brief reflection about why we're here and what we're doing, and then lead into a guided meditation for a while, and then open it up to some discussion, just questions, either about the practice or about the teachings. That's the general format. Maybe there'll be time for some walking meditation as well. So I think the question naturally arises, you know, what is it that brings us here this afternoon, that brings us to practice, that brings us to meditation, especially when we, you know, look out at what's happening in the world today and actually throughout history. You know, it just seems to be a catalog of distress, you know, in so many different arenas, whether it's, you know, the environment, just the degradation of the environment, or social injustice, or political oppression, you know, a war or violence. It's just the list goes on and on. And I wonder how often people actually inquire deeply into the causes of so much of that suffering. You know, not all of it, but so much of it is caused by the forces of greed and the forces of hatred and the forces of delusion in the mind. That's what drives so many of the actions, you know, that are taken in the world that bring about so much suffering to so many people. But I think very often we are addressing or trying to address the symptoms and not actually looking at the root causes. And of course, when we do look, we find that greed and hatred and anger and fear and envy and jealousy and delusion are not limited to others. Of course, this is the great discovery of meditation practice. It was summed up quite nicely in a line from a book I read back in the 60s. Maybe some of you remember it, from Zorba the Greek by Kazantzakis. And one of the lines in the book is, "Self-knowledge is always bad news." And I think anybody who has actually spent time meditating understands the truth of that. So what we're doing here is not divorced from what happens in the world. I mean, it's really through our own understanding that we can begin to understand what it is that's driving so much in the world, and through that understanding begin to at least have some clear sense of how best to address those issues. You know, it's really bringing compassion, wisdom to compassion. You know, we may want to do something to help, but if we don't have the wisdom of understanding what will really be most effective, sometimes the action is not that effective. I first became interested, you know, in meditation. I was in the Peace Corps in Thailand. I finished college, studied philosophy, applied actually to go to East Africa, but somehow the karmic forces at work, the Peace Corps offered me this position of teaching English in Thailand, in Bangkok, which I was delighted to go to. And after some time there, I started attending these discussion groups held at one of the famous temples in Bangkok, the Marble Temple, led by an Indian monk and a British monk, you know, for the Westerners who were interested and in Bangkok at that time. But having studied philosophy in school and having that bent of mind, I would go to these discussion groups just asking endless questions. You know, and people stopped coming because I came. We've probably all been in groups like that, with someone like that. And I think it was out of some desperation that one of the monks said, "Joseph, why don't you try meditating?" And I was 21 years old, about 21, 22, in the Far East for the first time. You know, it was all very, very exotic to me. I didn't know anybody who had ever meditated. And just the whole idea of meditation and Buddhism and the Far East and all of it was just so exotic is the word. You know. So I get together all my paraphernalia and I sit down. I set the alarm clock for 5 minutes, you know, so I don't overdo it. But something important happened. I mean, it was amazing. It wasn't a big enlightenment experience, but something very important happened in that first 5 minutes. And I saw that, quite to my surprise, that there was a way to turn the attention inward as well as looking outward. My whole life I had been looking outward through my mind to the world. And there I was sitting down and just with the most simple of methods, learning to turn the attention systematically, turn the attention and look inward into my own mind. So that just seemed so extraordinary to me, you know, that there was a way to do this and a well-marked way to do this. I got so excited by this that I started inviting my friends to come and watch me meditate. And I'm still doing it. So thank you all for coming this afternoon. So I finished the Peace Corps and then I came back to the States. And I tried actually to continue the practice on my own. It was really difficult. I mean, I didn't really have a good understanding of the practice or what I was doing. And I remember going off on some retreat, the self-retreat, and I tried doing everything I had read about or heard about. So I was watching the breath and concentrating on my third eye and doing a mantra, and you know, I got terribly confused. And I realized then that I needed a teacher. You know, that this way of looking into the mind, although in some way very simple, I didn't really have a good understanding yet of how to proceed. And at that time, there was no one in this country that I knew of that was teaching this kind of meditation. So I decided to go back to Asia, stopped in India on my way back. I thought I was going back to Thailand. And I was just going around looking at different ashrams, looking for a teacher or a teaching that I could connect with. Finally, after a couple of months of wandering, I ended up in Bodh Gaya, which is the place, as you know, of the Buddha's enlightenment. And at that time, it was an extremely small, undeveloped village with the great Mahabodhi temple, beautiful temple, dedicated to the site of the Buddha's awakening. And at that time, there were, I think, maybe 5 or 6 Westerners there. You know, so it was very, very quiet at that time. And I met Munindraji, my first teacher. And he said something in the very beginning which just captured my interest and has held it. You know, for the ensuing 45 years. And it was the most simple statement, but it was so, so to the point. And he said, "If you want to understand your mind, sit down and observe it." It just seemed so simple and so straightforward to me. You know, there was no ritual, there was nothing to join, there was nothing extra. If you want to understand your mind, sit down, not necessarily literally sit down, but sitting among the different postures, turn inward and observe it. And it just made so much sense to me. How else can we understand our minds except by doing that. And so the straightforwardness of it and the common senseness of it was very appealing to me. So I sat down and began to watch my mind. And as most of you know, as we begin to look at the mind, and by mind here, we use the term mind in the Buddhist sense, but in English it's not quite a complete translation of the Pali and Sanskrit word, because when we say mind, we really mean mind-heart. Because mind in the Buddhist sense includes consciousness and awareness and emotion and thought and intuition and silence. So when you hear the word mind, think of it as big mind or heart mind, because that's really what the word signifies. So when we begin this practice of turning our attention inward and looking at this heart mind, we discover something else that Munindraji would say very often, that it's simple, but it's not easy. So it's a very simple practice, but it's not easy. Because what happens? We sit and we give the mind a very simple, uncomplicated object of attention, like the breath, although it could be many different things. But we often use the breath as a starting place. And we're with the breath, once or twice or three times or 10 times, and then the mind is off. And what does off mean? It doesn't really mean that the mind has gone anyplace. It just means that a thought has arisen and that we're not aware that it's arisen and that we get lost in the story of the thought. And so we're in kind of like the dream state of a thought, not knowing that we're thinking until that moment when we reawaken. We wake up to the fact, oh, yes, thinking, back to the breath. So a lot of the training, not a lot, really all of the training, is practicing staying awake. It's practicing staying awake to whatever the present arising experience is. And to notice all those times, as we're not awake, we get caught up, we get lost in a thought, and then pay attention to the moment of reawakening. And as we do this, we begin to notice the various patterns of our conditioning. And this is where it ties in again to what I said in the beginning. We begin to see the patterns in the mind, the forces in the mind, which lead to suffering. Suffering for ourselves, suffering in the world. And it just becomes so obvious because we're paying attention. We see the force of grasping, of desire, of wanting. We see the force of anger, annoyance, irritation, fear. There's a long list. We see the force of delusion and also the wholesome forces in the mind. We really begin to appreciate what's wholesome in us. The feelings, the mind states of generosity, of kindness, of love, of compassion, of care, of understanding, of wisdom. So sometimes I think of this heart mind and what's going on, sometimes I think of it as kind of a Star Wars of the mind. this mysterious energy which we call mind, with all these forces at play, and some of the forces lead to harm and suffering, and some of the forces lead to what is good and wholesome. And for people who do not take the time to turn inward and pay attention, then it's simply our lives simply are playing out whatever habituated conditioned patterns happen to be there. Without awareness, we have no choice. We're just acting out the patterns of our conditioning. It's through the power of awareness, and this is where I think that the word mindfulness in English doesn't do justice to the power of the mind state that it is. Because mindfulness in English, at least to me, it just is such a prosaic word. know, you're being mindful, it doesn't have much pizzazz, you know, like compassion or wisdom, you know, or even awakening. But when we stop to really look at the power of mindfulness, of what that particular faculty in the mind does, how it operates, what its operational function is in the mind and in our lives, it's just this enormous appreciation and respect for the development of this particular quality. Because it's precisely the power of mindfulness that allows us to discern within ourselves those forces which are wholesome, those forces which are unwholesome. It's only through mindfulness that we can see that. And as we see it, we can make wiser choices. As we make wiser choices, we lead happier lives. And we become the cause of happiness for others. Now, Thich Nhat Hanh, the great Vietnamese master, he summed it up very simply. He said, happiness is available. Please help yourselves to it. So that's really what we're doing. We're helping ourselves to happiness by understanding its causes. And then being the cause, as best we can, for the happiness of others. I thought we'd just go into some meditative practice and practice this very remarkable mind state. Out of interest, how many of you here have never done any mindfulness meditation before? Okay. So I'll guide it a bit, and so this will be an introduction to it. And for those many of you who have meditated before, you can either ignore me or let it be a reminder.